Okay, now, that's it. Now we come to survey of the Old Testament, study number 21. And this evening is on the book of Ecclesiastes. And by way of introduction, we consider the book, the author, and the theme. Now, as far as the book is concerned, we come to see that this book is telling us that the writer has tasted everything that the world has to offer. Pleasures, power, prestige, popularity, you name it, he had it. He had the power, he had the ability to have all these things. And yet, after experiencing all these things, he remained unsatisfied. And he came to the conclusion that everything in this world is futile and without purpose when there is no living relationship with God. This basically is what the book is all about. And the title of the book comes from the Hebrew word Kohelet, which means the speaker who leads in an assembly of God's people. Very much like King Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 8, when he called the assembly together to dedicate the temple, he was leading the whole congregation in worship, and therefore he was the preacher. And the word occurs 7 times in chapter 1, verse 1, verse 2, verse 12, chapter 7, verse 27, chapter 12, verse 8, 9, and 10. So this book has been called Ecclesiastes, or the preacher. Now, the author of the book has been called into question in recent days, just as other books of the Bible have been called into question. People today like to question the traditional view, and sometimes they may be able to put things right, but most of the time they are wrong, because they simply have a spirit that is not submitted to truth, and we suspect not even submitted to God, and often they want to find fault with the Bible. In the case of the book of Ecclesiastes, although the name of Solomon is not mentioned, nevertheless all the descriptions and indications point to Solomon as the author. And some of the things that must be noted are this. In chapter 1, verse 1, if you look carefully, it says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." Now, to be a preacher who is the son of David, who is king of Jerusalem, now it's a little bit too difficult to find all these three combinations in one person. And we know that Solomon was a preacher, and he was the son of David. He was king in Jerusalem. Similarly, verse 12. And so we would conclude that based on this alone, the indication is that Solomon was the writer. Then you take note in verse 16 that he possessed a wisdom far beyond the other men in his time. In verse 16 of chapter 1, he says, "I commune with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge." So you can see here that a man of such wisdom is hard to find. But we know that Solomon was one such man, because when God chose him to be king, he was asked to request what he wanted, and instead of asking for riches and health and wealth, he instead asked for wisdom to rule over God's people. And God was pleased with his answer and blessed him with his request of unusual wisdom far beyond the men of his time. But at the same time, God blessed him with power, wealth, and health. And then, sad to say, Solomon indulged himself in all the pleasures of the world. And this is described in chapter 2, verse 1 to verse 3. We are told there in chapter 2, verse 1, "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, but surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I search in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives." Solomon was not only capable, able to do all this, but he did all this. And we know that his splendor, the splendor of his palace and his life and his kingdom was really beyond the possibility of description today. The Queen of Sheba, her heart trembled and melted when she came and saw it for herself and said that half of it had not been told her. Then this man, the writer, undertook extensive building projects. You see in chapter 2, verse 4 to verse 6, I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. Now we know that Solomon did all this. And then we are told in chapter 12, verse 9, that he had written and compiled together many proverbs in chapter 12, verse 9. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. Now you put all this together, you find that it has to be Solomon. It has to be Solomon. We are not saying it is impossible for some other man to totally fulfill all these descriptions, but the one we know of in the Old Testament was Solomon, no other. So we can confidently say that Solomon was the one who wrote this. And then furthermore, the Proverbs contained in this book itself are like those found in the book of Proverbs, which we know was written by Solomon. So we conclude that the traditional view must be right, and people who try to assail this view have flimsy ground. They have much work to do in order to try and shake this position. And what about the theme of the book? From the content we already know, there is a theme that runs through. Life is meaningless without God. And chapter 1, verse 2 virtually summarizes the whole book. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Okay? And of course he concludes that statement. He begins that book like that. He concludes that book by saying in verse 13 of the last chapter, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. So it's almost like he's saying, he opens the book by saying, you're going to discover everything in life amounts to this. It's futile. It's useless. But as I lead you through to consider our relationship with God, then you come to the conclusion that it is only when you come into a living relationship with your God that life makes sense. So it's almost like he's shouting out the first half of his message. Then he's concluding with the other half of the message. The first half is that without God, life is meaningless. The second half is, when you find God, then life begins to be worthwhile living. He's not saying that all the problems of life will go, but rather he's saying that you can then handle the problems of life and see that it is worthwhile living. So let's come to the outline of the book. Now, when we consult the commentators, you discover that through the centuries, there is a great lack of unanimity with respect to the purpose of the book. People ask, what is the purpose? Why is the writer writing this book? And how is he accomplishing it? And that will help us to determine how we may analyze the book so that we can preach effectively. And many commentators in recent days divide the book into four discourses. The book is divided into four sermons. In chapter 1, verse 1, we have the beginning of a new section until chapter 3, verse 16. Then from there, a new section begins, the second section, until chapter 6, verse 1. Then a new section begins from there until chapter 8, verse 1. Okay? And in each section, in each sermon, the writer first views life as a humanist, that is, a person who looks upon human beings as supreme, as most important, and all else are insignificant except man and his well-being. Or a secularist, that means one who looks at life from the human perspective, from this worldly perspective, without consideration of the spiritual dimension, without considering eternity. So he is a secular man. Okay? So first he looks at life as a humanist or secularist, then as a believer. Now why don't we say that he looks first at life as an atheist, a person who does not believe in the existence of God? Now we do not say that because throughout he seems to know the presence of God. And in those days, people in that part of the world anyway, knows the existence of God. They acknowledge the existence of God. And at the most, they can be agnostic. That means they may say that they don't know who that God is. But they nevertheless would not be atheists saying that there is no God. They would say that there is God, but they do not want to have a relationship, a living relationship with God. They do not want to know too much about God. God is at a distance to them. So they want to see, or this writer wants to see man and the observable world, the world that can be observed. So as far as knowing God is concerned, he pushes it aside, although he does believe that existence of God. Now such a man who looks upon human beings as most important in the world and life, temporal life on this earth as the only thing that matters, now such a man will become dissatisfied until he turns to God and then views life from the perspective of a believer. So the writer is doing just that. In each section, he looks at life as a person who does not have a living relationship with God, then he looks at life as a person who now has a living relationship with God. Now, another way of looking at the book is to view the author as being under deep conviction by God for his godless life. And knowing the background of Solomon, we come to realize that this book is an expression of his sorrow in having gone astray. His many pagan wives led him astray. He allowed himself to indulge in his pleasures, the pleasures of the flesh, to the point that his spiritual life was gradually eaten away, to the extent that he was very badly backslidden. Okay? And if we look at it from that perspective, knowing that it fitted Solomon's life, then you discover that the book takes on another dimension. It is actually a deeply personal and sorrowful book. It is intended actually as a warning for us all not to go down that path. So in so far as the purpose of the book is concerned, we may look upon it as a warning for us not to go astray from our God, not to backslide. Otherwise we will live a life that is meaningless, empty, void of purpose. Okay? So now let us look at the chapter divisions of the book. In chapter 1, verse 1 to verse 11, we have the introduction. And in the introduction, the writer looks upon life as a whole. He wants to introduce his book, and he says, life as a whole is vanity. And the word vanity occurs a total of 37 times. As we have seen already in chapter 1, verse 2, he declares, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now what is the meaning of this word vanity? Today when we say a person is vain and he is full of vanity, he is engaging in things that are worthless, empty, and there is an indication that he is proud of what he is doing. He is arrogant, you see. There is a certain egoism in him. But when we look at the original Hebrew word, actually, it is simply referring to the state of uselessness. So the better translation might be futility, meaninglessness, pointlessness. So we are not assessing the character of the person here. We are not saying whether he is proud or not. We are rather saying that life lived out in a certain way is worthless, futile. Everything you do which you think is something ends up as nothing. And linked with this word are expressions such as under the sun. So many times, 29 times altogether, the expression under the sun is given. Then upon the earth, 7 times, and under heaven, 3 times. So broad, sweeping phrases like that are given to us to help us see life in the broad perspective like that. And the conclusion is that everything under the sun is futile. And the expression under the sun is actually a key phrase because it covers all aspects of life considered from a purely mundane, that is, practical and daily point of view. From an earthly point of view, it is actually futile. So that covers the introduction. Then part 1 begins from chapter 1 verse 12 to chapter 6 verse 12. Now that is looking at life from the perspective of someone who just want to enjoy and give free license to the desires of the flesh. Anything you want, you do. See? And you discover that everything the author tried did not bring fulfillment. He was never satisfied. He was never happy. And it speaks to us today. It speaks today of many people who are like that. Look at the many people around us. And look at ourselves. Many of us, once upon a time, was like that. Some people pursue what appear to be honorable things. Science, for example. Scientific discovery. Being the top of academia. You know. Publishing many papers, making a name for yourself. Or people seek worldly wisdom and philosophy. Some pride themselves as philosophers. Others seek pleasure, drinking. Others building. Six men especially like to build. They build and build and build and leave a name for themselves. They want to be the father of this and the father of that. You see? And businessmen also, they are very good at building and building. Then others engage in farming, big farms. Maybe it's not so much known in this country. But still, there are some individuals who buy up plantations. And their companies are well known. They're gardening on a smaller scale especially. Then amassing possessions. Some people just accumulate. More houses, more shop lots, more land, more property of any kind. Others accumulate wealth. They want to be rich. They hit the first million. Then the millions are supposed to multiply to become more millions. And then they aim to be the first billionaire among his peers. Then after that he wants to compete with the few billionaires in the country. Then he wants to enter the book of who is who, to be the richest people in the world. Others pursue music. They enjoy music, which is not wrong in itself, but they go to the extent of indulging in it to the exclusion of everything. They thought that they will find the meaning of life, fulfillment, satisfaction in all this. The preacher searched but did not find the answer in materialism, that is, amassing property and enjoying the things of this world. And in adopting the philosophy of fatalism, everything is fated. That is the theory that everything is already predetermined. And nothing can be changed. Then there is belief in deism. That is a religion that is without revelation. You are God, I am God. God is everywhere. Okay? And nothing answered the deepest longing of his heart and mind. Excuse me. So he realized that by excluding God from the world, nothing makes sense. Nothing. Some people learn early. Some people learn late. Then you take note that you may be a person with ideals. You set goals and you have ambitions. You see? And this man was an intelligent man. He did not just like a mindless person just accumulate wealth. No. But he has ideals, his aim. And when he tried to do all this without reference to God, what did he find? Again, dissatisfaction and frustration. See? And he looked around him. He realizes that people in this world face oppression, envy, greed, loneliness. And so you discover human beings, finally speaking, looking from the view of a person who is far from God, such a person is no better than the animals. He says that the bodies of men, just like animals, return to the dust. It is as though that is the end. You live, you pursue, you have your ideals, but along the way, you just die, you decay into dust. Okay? Now, by reasoning like this with us concerning the futility and meaninglessness of all earthly pursuits, the writer actually prepares the readers for the second half of the book, which actually gives us counsel and comfort. So let me repeat. You see, the writer is trying to show to us that when you pursue the things of this world with high ideals, you pursue them without God in your life, you will not be happy. You will find dissatisfaction. You still find emptiness in your life. So by arguing it out like this, he is trying to make us sense our own emptiness so that we will be driven to the realization that we need God in our life. Okay? And we move on to part two, how to live with meaninglessness. This world is meaningless without God. Now, how do you handle that? You see, the troubles of life will not go away. How do you handle all this? See, he's not saying, you know, by living in a certain way, all troubles will go. By living in a certain way, then all labors and all sorrow will go. No. But he's rather saying, there is another way of living which does not remove sorrows, which does not remove pain, which does not remove all the jealousies and envies and rivalries and the oppression around us. But it gives us the strength to live out life facing all this. It gives us a different view of life which makes life meaningful despite all this. Okay? And that is the thing to note, that he's not proposing a life that is free from pain and sorrow, but rather he's proposing to us a life that is meaningful in spite of pain and sorrow. Okay? And so in chapter 7 verse 1 to chapter 12 verse 8, we may look upon it as Solomon giving advice on being sober-minded and being forward-looking. He's trying to say to us that there is another way of looking at life. And he recommends that we must make the best of all life circumstances. It is not perfect, no doubt, but there is a way of looking at life such that we do not get depressed by the many difficulties here. Look at chapter 7, in verse 14, it says, in the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider, surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that that man can find out nothing that will come after him. So whether it is good or bad, whether you are facing with happy situation or sorrowful situation, look upon it this way, that God is still in control. See what can be done out of the situation. And he is trying to warn us that if you continue to have negative thoughts, then in life, nothing will be done. Nothing good will be accomplished. So in chapter 11, verse 4, it says, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. So if you are like someone who is determining which way the wind will blow, will the wind blow today? You know what? It looks like the wind is going to blow. Then it's wasted if I sow, because all this will be blown away. See? And if you look at the clouds, you see, you say that, you know, will it rain today? If it's raining, then how am I going to harvest my crops? You see? Then you decided not to harvest. So you gain nothing. Okay? So you discover that when you are always having this negative thoughts, it paralyzes you so that no good work is done. And instead, he recommends that we do all things for God's sake, in His name. You discover in chapter 11, verse 6, he says, in the morning, sow your seed, and in the evening, do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. And applied to life, when you are young, do whatever is right, whatever is good, whatever is true. And when you are older, do the same. Don't think that when you are old already, my life is over, I'm just waiting to die. You never know. Great good may still come out of your life. And this is particularly relevant to those who are in the later years of their life. Often they tend to think that their years are over. There's no need for them to have any ambition, for any good to be done, just sit down and wait to die. And that is not good for them, because they fail to hand the totality of their life to God to be used by Him. So the answer to life is therefore the fear of God, and throughout this is emphasized. Look at chapter 8 verse 12, for example. We are told there in chapter 8 verse 12, though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before Him. So that is his conclusion. Whatever your background may be, whatever the circumstances, if we can bring them to God and live for Him, trusting in Him, then you discover that life takes on new meaning. He's not saying just because you trust in God, all this trouble will go. That needs to be emphasized. We are not saying that when you trust in God, you will have no sickness. Instead, you will have good health. You will have no poverty. You will be wealthy, and so on. No. That is the type of gospel that is being preached today. But the preacher is so realistic. He's saying, you come to God. You come and trust in Him. You fear Him. Obey Him. And these troubles will not go away, but rather you will see them in a different perspective, and life becomes worthwhile living. It becomes meaningful. And another thing to be noted is death. The preacher is constantly conscious of death. And this is also something that weighs a lot of people down. Some young children from early years, they are already conscious of death. See? We have known many children, including one of our boys, from very early, you know, they cried because why? They fear death. They know that they will go to hell. And death is something that weighs down upon them. And you know, even emperors, the first emperor of China, you see, he's trying to find medicine that will keep him immortal, will not make him die. And people today are looking for medicines of various kinds to remove wrinkles, to look younger and to be healthier and to live longer. We want to preserve our life. And we all do not want to die. Death weighs us down. And Solomon is constantly weighed down by the prospect of death. And he recognizes that actually he's at the mercy of God. God is the one who determines when he will go. And he says in chapter 9 verse 1, for I considered all this in my heart so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything they see before them. So it is in God's hand. Everything is in God's hand. And therefore, by trusting in God and looking at life the way God desires us to look, you discover that there is hope and there is confidence in God. And so by the time we arrive at chapter 11, in verse 5 and verse 6, he says this, As you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. So by looking upon God as our center of reference, the purpose for our living, we will go on doing what is right and good in His sight, no matter what the circumstances. Then the conclusion, chapter 12, verse 9 to verse 14. Solomon remembers the days before his backsliding, when he set in order many proverbs, we are told, and he wrote words of truth. Those, as he looked back, were meaningful days. See? And he came back to God. He wants us to realize that we must also come back to God, that the secret of life is to live in obedience to God and trust His goodness, wisdom, and justice. You may not find justice in this world, but God will give justice. You may need wisdom, God will give you wisdom. You don't find anything good in this world, God's goodness must be noted in our lives. Okay? So he ends with that very memorable passage there. Perhaps we should read that, chapter 11, starting from verse 9. He says, "And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright, words of truth." Excuse me. "The words of the wise are like goats." Goats are those sticks used by herdsmen to poke at their cows and their cattle to make them move. So the words of the wise are like goats, probing us, reminding us. "And the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd." So you know, nails on the wall for you to hang things on. Otherwise you have nowhere to hang. So words of the scholars are like well-driven nails are given by one shepherd. Verse 12, "And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." Well, don't misunderstand the preacher. He's not saying that don't study. Books are useless. Read only the Bible. He's not saying that. We know that he himself produced many books and he tried to pass on his wisdom to others. Okay? But he's trying to help us see things in perspective. Don't learn from the wisdom of man. And even the truths that are discovered in this world, you can pursue them for a living, for your studies, to earn a degree and to get a good job. But remember, finally speaking, it is more important to know God, to fear Him, to live for Him. And that should be our desire. So we come now to the last section, Christ and His Church. Now, if we want to look for Christ and His Church in this book, you discover there are no prophecies concerning Christ, no theophanies, no types of Christ in this book. And yet, it is such a valuable book. Why? Like what is mentioned in 2 Timothy 3:15. It contributes to make you wise for salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus. You see now that by helping to argue out His case in so powerful a way to show to us that you can experience everything and try everything in this life and you can taste everything and test everything until your heart is satisfied. But without God in your life, all these will end in disappointment, dissatisfaction, disillusionment. Okay? And in so doing, He therefore drives us to the one who reveals to us the secret of life, namely the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? And really, the writer speaks to certain hearts, you know. There are people who are like that. They want to experience all of life. They want to search out wisdom. They will seek any wise man, any older man. They will listen. They are very teachable. And they learn fast, you see. And they explore. They travel. They do a lot of things in order to gain experience. But the conclusion is still the same. You will still feel disillusioned, unhappy. There is a deep inner void that is not met until you know the Lord Jesus Christ. Okay? So the book emphasizes the fear of God. And the fear of God consists of two aspects. First, the Lord we love. Then, the life we live. Now, with regard to the Lord we love, we have to ask, do we respect God? Do we worship Him? And do we hunger for Him? We need to examine the pursuits of our life, even the legitimate pursuits, such as studies and careers. These can draw a believer away from the God whom he professes to believe in. So it is good at this time to examine whether your studies or your career is actually drawing you away from really giving due respect to God, worshipping Him as you ought, hungering for Him as you ought. Then as far as our life is concerned, we must ask whether we live a holy and useful life for our God. Now we really cannot afford to follow the crowd and live worldly lives. We need to examine our work, our hobbies, the sport we engage in, holidays we take, our family, all our loving concern for our family. All this may receive more attention and time and energy than our concern for the spread of the gospel, our concern for missions, our concern for the lost, our concern for the extension of Christ's kingdom. We must be reminded afresh that death is a reality, that life is short. We do not want to lose sight of this fact. Now let me just add an illustration. In this recent trip to Indonesia, I was with four American missionaries. One is a teacher by profession who is a missionary in Indonesian Papua, which also used to be known as Irian Jaya. Another couple are doctors, missionaries in Papua New Guinea. Another is a young man who is also a doctor from Kyrgyzstan. He came to join the team to be involved in a fact-finding mission. We were able to share together for a little before we parted ways. I said, if ever you pass this way, please feel free to drop by, stay with us. And if ever you think of taking a break, please come to us, because we have made up our mind that we want to be of ministry to those who are in the mission field. Okay? And the missionary couple, the man, said to me, and the same applies to you. If you come our way, please drop by. And you're most welcome to come and visit us. I said, you know, I have been thinking about this few days. I sometimes think, for ourselves and for our children, are we not being carried away by the comforts of life? We serve God and then we enjoy the comforts of life at the same time. What if there is no comforts of life? Which would you choose? And I say, I think I want to expose my children to the mission field more. Our church is small, I told him, and it is hard to move everyone to be mission conscious. But I certainly would like to bring my children to visit Papua New Guinea one day. So yes, you are most welcome. And this is the little that I hope to accomplish. If God so wills, I will expose our four boys to life in a mission field. And if God will just give them salvation and also give them a heart for Him to serve Him rather than choose the vain things of this world. that would have been something worthwhile doing. And I hope you get the message that I fear that we are too caught up with the comforts of life, forgetting that people elsewhere have denounced this world. They rarely live the life of the stranger and pilgrim of this earth. They just quietly serve in Papua New Guinea. On and off they go to America, give reports of their work, visit their children, but off they came, back they came to the mission field. They have no desire to live the life of comfort in America. Okay? So it is a challenge to us, and this book brings us to the remembrance of these things. So in conclusion, do not get caught up in pursuits, however good and commendable, that lead you away from God. And secondly, the antidote to disillusionment, being cynical and finding life meaningless, is in fearing God and keeping His commandments. I hope this truth will come back to you when you are in need of them. So are there questions or comments?